Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion.
All right, it's Saturday night. Is there a better place to be than Kansas City on a Saturday night when the ground's not frozen? So last week we talked about Walpurgisnacht and being the night Hitler committed suicide. And it also ties into dancing around bonfires and things like that, which I'm sure most of our listeners actually participated in last weekend. I didn't want to mention that it was also a high witches confluence where witches have the most power. So I guess Chief Justice Alito, being aware of this, thought he better launch his attack against Roe versus Wade. Unfortunately, we're not going to talk about Operation Paperclip tonight, and the Nazis joining the CIA after the war or any of that. So we're going to stick a little bit closer to the Roe versus Wade issue. And I think we'll start out with clip 407, Professor Wolf talking about nonprofit organizations. Mike, are you there? Oh,
yeah,
Mike's not here.
I'm here, buddy.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, I am.
Excellent. So, so how was your Walpurgisnacht?
How was what?
How was your bonfire and all that?
Well, there's so much storm damage at my place that I couldn't burn all the wood. I still got more winter tree limbs and things to chop up, but you know, we had a fire, but that was about it. we couldn't get it big enough, but we got it too big and burned down the house. So,
right.
But we had a great bonfire.
But, that's right, and you were also in the basement during the time we were broadcasting last weekend.
Well, there was a tornado. It was considered, I don't know what you'd call it. The problem was that when it gets dark out here, and we don't have any sirens. And so, you know, we have no community. We can barely hear the sirens if they go off in a town 4.5 miles away. That's the nearest town. So when it gets dark and there's tornadoes in the area, we get a little gun shy. And that's why we're setting up a up-to-the-minute. We're joining the Weather Underground, Carl. We're joining Weather
right.
Underground and setting up a weather station out here, which will have up-to-the-minute stuff. So we'll, any of you viewers, you regular people who listen to Radio Free Kansas, you'll be able to go to Weather Underground and type in our weather station. And within just a week or so, it'll be online. And you'll be able to watch the tornado come right by our house, and like it did a few days ago, and scare the living shit out of us. It came within about a mile and a half. One, and it wasn't a very big tornado. It was really, it just did some slight damage to some other neighbors of ours. Nothing major. Blew up a chicken coop and knocked over some lawn ornaments. So I mean, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. But I would call it a dust devil. But even a dust devil at night could be some pretty freaky stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. So you've been cutting down limbs and things in your area, or helping out neighbors,
a little of that, but mainly the limbs in our house from the damage from that windstorm, the dust devil that came through with the wind. It wasn't really a dust devil; it was a very small tornado. But it was at night, and when we got up, I noticed there was the tops of some of our trees, some cedar trees, were knocked down. And these were cedar trees that were like probably 100 years old, because our farm, our 10 acres, the house is 105 years old. So these were old trees that were knocked down. And I was sort of, you know, that's what I've been doing. Whenever the weather allows, I go out and chainsaw off limbs and wood stuff. And we burn some wood, you know, and all that. So. We had a great May Day show, listeners, on May 1st, and it's there in the archives. You can, you know, go back and check it out. And it included some stuff, talk about witches, for your benefit, Carl.
Yeah, well, because Alito, his finding on Roe versus Wade is based on 1671 ruling, which was later used during the Salem witch trials.
I haven't read that completely. It's a 100-page leak, and I haven't. But I heard that. I heard that he was citing some extremely old law. I mean, it wasn't even law. I guess he cited some really old shit, you know. So
it said witches are true because the Bible says it so.
Yeah.
Okay, let's.
Okay.
Okay, so we got Professor Milton. Oh, no, I'm sorry. We've got. That was supposed to be a surprise. Okay, so Richard Wolff, and then we'll let Milton Friedman give his rebuttal. And then I think we got a couple good ballads. So I think we got Joe Strummer doing redemption songs starting out. And then we've got John Prine, The Great Compromise, on the end.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you'll like it. All right, 407. Hit it, Mike.
Old pirates, yes, they rob I. Sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophet while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We got to fulfill the book. So won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, yes, they rob I, sold I to the merchant ship. Minutes after they took I from a bottomless pit. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We got to fulfill the book. So won't you help to sing these songs of freedom?
This is Richard Wolf from Democracy at Work, responding to another Ask Prof. Wolf question. Emily's question is about nonprofit academic hospitals, about how and why they're able to pay such enormous salaries to the people who sit at the top of their administrative hierarchies, and how that comes to be, especially since these hospitals, these nonprofit hospitals, like their profit or for-profit counterparts, are so likely to overwork and underpay the vast majority of their nurses, nurses' aides, and all the people who make the hospital actually run below the level of the doctor. First, this whole concept of non-profit is a bit of a hustle, and that has to be exposed. What we're talking about here is taxation. Some institutions get themselves exempt from taxes. They had to fight back in the 19th or 20th century to get themselves exempted from taxes, and that was a hustle right there, because other businesses still have to pay taxes, weren't able to get an exemption, although many tried. And so hospitals could and did succeed in getting themselves exempted from taxes. This does not mean that you don't make a profit. It just means you don't pay taxes if and when you do. But you know, this was always a problem because the businesses and the people who still have to pay taxes looked with a certain skepticism at these institutions that got out of it. So they christened themselves with a new name. They rebranded and they called themselves not-for-profit, because that sounds a heck of a lot better than tax-exempt, which is the truth of it all. Non-profits can make a profit. They just don't pay a tax on it, and they are required to plow that profit back into the business, which many businesses do anyway. So as I said, it's a bit of a hustle. In the United States, about two-thirds of our hospitals are not-for-profit, and about one-third are for-profit. So that begins our story here. What about the for-profit one, guys? If a hospital were run as a co-op, if all the people who worked in a hospital together decided how to run the hospital, they wouldn't run it like a capitalist corporation. That's what a co-op is as a difference. It would be democratically run. It wouldn't be top-down. And then you wouldn't copy the high salaries for those at the top and the order-taking, drudgery, underpayment, and overwork imposed on the nurses and all the other people in a hospital. If discussions like these, of issues like this that affect everybody, seem to you worthwhile, if you'd like to see this way of thinking part of the national conversation about hospital care, medical care, health care, and all the rest, then please partner with us. Share this video with friends, coworkers, family, with anyone who might be interested. That way we can extend our reach and influence on what happens to health care in this country.
Here he comes again, Milton Friedman, and boy, does he make an entrance now, because this is a blockbuster book, Free to Choose, which, not surprisingly, features a very attractive, flattering, professorial picture of our guest on the front. You are the counselor to presidents and presidential candidates. It's really a wonderful spot to be. And
I've given advice to many presidential aspirants. It hasn't always been taken. In fact, most of the time it hasn't been.
I think we can assume that it's certainly not being taken now.
Well, I haven't given any advice to President Carter.
But none has been solicited, I think.
None has been solicited. But that really doesn't matter, because I publish my views in Newsweek and other areas. Anybody who wants to know my opinions or my views has them readily available. Nobody has to call me on the telephone to find out.
Yeah.
The only time I talked to President Carter was in his election and his inauguration, when there was an absolutely hilarious incident. He tried to call me to congratulate me on the Nobel Award, and he told his secretary to get Milton Friedman. Well, it so happened there was a speechwriter in Gerry Ford's White House called Milton Friedman. This is in the interim after Gerry Ford has been turned out. And all of a sudden, the telephone rings, and Milton Friedman in the White House hears President-elect Carter is on the phone, and he thinks Santa Claus is coming.
Sure, he's going to. This will be the unprecedented act of being asked to come on another administration.
But it turned out he was really trying to get me, and he finally got me up in Vermont, where we were at the time.
Let me see if I can express in very imprecise terms and very briefly the core of your statement here, a personal statement. We have too much government. We are not allowing the free enterprise system to work as your most favored historical figure, Adam Smith, suggested it would work if we just let things alone.
But let's suppose after I had reasoned with you, after I had argued with you, I had failed to persuade you. Do I have the right to use force to prevent you from disposing of your own life? The clearest case of that, I certainly do not. I certainly do not. And you do not. Hmm. And certainly, you do not have the right to put your hand in the pockets of other people in order to prevent somebody from doing something in his own value system. Now, you know, it's an interesting thing. Every time you bring up issues like this, people don't recognize what's been happening. Where is the rate of suicide highest? Is it in the countries that are free enterprise countries, or is it in socialist countries? Sweden has the highest rate of suicide of any of the Western countries. The last time I looked at the figures, maybe they've changed.
Your statement against government growth and too much spending, do I assume that you bring the same free-to-be-irresponsible statements against military spending?
Well,
$140 billion?
You say $140 billion. 15 years ago, military spending was over twice as much as the spending of HEW. Today, the spending of HEW is over twice as much, is about twice as much as military spending. 15, 20 years ago, before Vietnam, military spending was 9% of the national income. Today, it's between 4 and 5%. I said earlier the two basic functions of the government are to protect the nation against foreign enemies,
yes,
and to protect the citizen against his fellows. Military spending is essential for the first. Of course, if we could do it in a private enterprise way, it'd be a lot cheaper.
Would you like to try?
I have never been able to figure out a way to turn the military, the defense of the country, over to private enterprise. I'd give a prize to anybody who can figure out how to do it.
Professor Friedman, there are critics who say that it already is, and that the reason old men declare wars is because they have a financial investment in the companies that make bombs and bullets and guns and uniforms and all it takes to get the...
I don't believe that for a moment. I don't doubt that the people who have those interests try to exert their influence in that way. But this is so serious and so important a matter that I really think it's
no
a travesty on what's going on.
No one is saying it's a conscious effort, but the fact that the profit is there has got to influence behavior.
You mean that's the reason why our military spending has gone down so sharply?
Are you, $140 billion isn't enough for you? Do you know how much an aircraft carrier costs? I got this just today, this week, from Senator Proxmire. $5 billion for the boat and $5 billion for the planes on it. $10 billion for one boat. How do you feel about that?
I think it's a lot too much, and might very likely If you could turn that over to private enterprise, it would cost half as much. But we have to have a strong military, and at the moment, let me get to this because I think it's very important. If this country is fundamentally threatened, in my opinion, it is threatened much more by our weak position in foreign affairs than it is threatened by any mistakes that we have made in economic management. We can recover from the mistakes in economic management. But if we put ourselves in a position in foreign policy of the kind we've been putting ourselves in, we cannot recover. We're through. It's a one-time law.
That's directly opposite the statements of many, many honorable, reasonable people who are saying it's the cost of bacon and the fact that the middle class can't make it to the next paycheck and the fact that several thousand people in the automobile industry are out of work that's going to threaten the integrity and strength of this country, not a group of students somewhere in
Iran. Well, you talk about a group of students. I'm not concerned about the group of students. I'm concerned about the Russian armies on both sides of that strait. I'm concerned about the fact that in our neglect we permitted the Russian to take over the base of Aden when the British left it in 1971, and they have built up a major military base with airplanes and so on, that they are now coming into Afghanistan. They've got both parts of the Persian Gulf in a pincers. Oh, my, how unrealistic can you be not to look at what's been happening to the relative strength and position of the Russians on the one hand and of ourselves on the other? And do you think they're spending that money and devoting their energy to that in order to have it sit idle?
All right, and what are you going to do with the workers who built all these airplanes after the order is canceled by the government? General Dynamics in Fort Worth, Boeing in Seattle. What is the economist going to do to help the economy, the local economy, when suddenly Big Daddy government cuts off the government?
Not a thing. Not a thing. And there's no reason to do anything because all of those people and the people who bid in that included in their bids an allowance for the possibility and the danger that they would be cut off. And they will have to adjust just as all the other people have to adjust. What are you going to do for the people who are out of work when the public at large suddenly changes from wanting one kind of pair of shoes to another kind of pair of shoes?
I really think it's one of the experiences of my generation and much of the ones after have been this experience of like incredible disappointment, which we can't express because, you know, when we think about it, everybody always says, oh, you mean all that Jetson stuff, like it was just a cartoon, yeah, you sucker. I mean, you know, we were silly to have ever believed that it was just something for kids. But actually, no. I mean, if you look at the time, like, you know, very reputable sources, you go to the museums, you go to, like, National Geographic, they would show maps of what the big space station and the Mars launch was going to be like. And, we had every reason to believe this. It's actually historically plausible to believe that this was the case because if you think about it, if you look at the early part of the 20th century, or a period around 1900, if you're a kid growing up reading Jules Verne in 1900, you know, there was a list of things that you expected to be invented by, say, 1950. You know, there were submarines, there were rocket ships, airplanes, there were going to be radios and TVs and things like that. And sure enough, there were. I mean, pretty much, I mean, you know, they didn't get the time machine. There was a few that didn't happen. But, you know, for the most part, most of the things that they expected to have been created by the time, you know, they were my age, 50, they got. So what happened? Because, you know, you have this whole generation where you have a similar list of science fiction inventions, which everybody expects they're going to have 50 years later. And, you know, maybe it's unrealistic to imagine we could have gotten all of them. But we didn't actually get any, not a single one. I mean, you know, people talk about, well, you know, iPhones are a little bit like a Star Trek communicator. Not really. We certainly don't have anything like tricorders, right? And even the stuff that seemed like they were about to emerge, like, you know, clones and cryogenics, they all kind of flopped and didn't really happen, you know.
I knew a girl who was almost a lady. She had a way with all the men in her life. Every inch of her blossomed in beauty. And she was born on the 4th of July. Well, she lived in an aluminum house trailer. And she worked in a jukebox saloon. And she spent all the money that I gave her just to see the old man in the moon. I used to sleep at the foot of Old Glory,
and awaken the dawn's early light. But much to my surprise, when I opened my eyes, I was a victim of the great compromise. Well, we'd go out on Saturday evening to the driving on Route 41, and it was there that I first suspected that she was doing what she'd already done. She said, "Johnny, won't you get me some popcorn?" And she knew I had to walk pretty far. And as soon as I passed through the moonlight, she hopped into a foreign sports car. A Hanoi Hudson. I used to sleep at the foot of Old Glory and awake in the dawn's early light. But much to my surprise, when I opened my eyes, I was a victim of the great compromise. This part here is for Tex Ritter, wherever he is. Because only Tex can sing this, right? He's not in hillbilly heaven yet, is he? No? Well, you know, I could have beat up that fella. But it was her that had hopped in his car. And many times I'd fought to protect her. But this time she was going too far. Now some folks, they call me a coward, 'cause I left her at the drive-in that night. But I'd druther, if I had my druthers, have names thrown at me than to fight for a thing that ain't right. Thank you, Tex. I used to sleep at the foot of Old Glory and awaken the dawn's early light. But much to my surprise, when I opened my eyes, I was a victim of the great compromise. Well, she writes all the fellas love letters, saying, "Greetings, come and see me real soon." And they go and line up in the bar room and spend the night in that sick woman's room. But sometimes I get awful lonesome, and I wish she was my girl instead. But she won't let me live with her, and she makes me live in my head. I used to sleep at the foot of Old Glory and awaken the dawn's early light. But much to my surprise, when I opened my eyes, I was a victim of the great compromise.
All right, we're back. It's the Abolitionist Hour. It's 72 degrees in Kansas City, 729. And so we're going to jump into the Roe versus Wade mix, the best that we could do, I think, so far. I think there'll be more stuff coming out this week if we need to continue it, which I don't think the conservatives are going to give up on this one. So this is 402, Mike, and go ahead and hit it. And
now, back to the likely demise of Roe versus Wade, which is galvanizing America's evangelicals. But who are they today, and how do they influence politics?
Oh,
75 years of white evangelicalism, and she tells our Michelle Martin how the Christian right is undermining democracy and fracturing
the grassroots. But there's another thing also, and that is the complicity of powerful white evangelical leaders as well, who for a long time gave cover to some of the more radical elements, thinking that they could control those, thinking that they, you know, were all on the same side in the end. And what we see now is the white evangelicals make up a significant portion of the Republican Party. They've helped define the agenda since the late 70s, at least, the respectable leaders and in the populist insurgency of abuse in evangelical churches, organizations, and homes. And you're exactly right. This is not just a story of, you know, occasional perpetrators who are doing terrible things. We have that everywhere. But what was really striking is the patterns that emerged over decades of good people, you know, Christian churchgoers, bystanders, even family members who would end up defending the perpetrators and blaming the women, even blaming young girls. But when I went back to the historical teachings from the 1960s and 1970s on sexuality and how to be a good Christian woman, it all became clear, because evangelical teachings on sex are just filled with this idea of gender difference, and God created men in one way, and men have an aggressive sexual drive, and that's just the way they're made. And so it's up to women who do not have that aggressive sexual drive to protect purity. So they should not tempt men who are not their husbands. Wives, then, when they are married, have to fulfill their husband's every sexual need. So any case of sexual misconduct, there is a woman to blame. A young girl could have seduced her dad, which seems absolutely absurd, but often the wife is blamed as well for not meeting her husband's sexual needs. And you have this purity culture that emerges that is very much based on a sexual double standard. And this is exactly what you see played out in these horrific stories of abuse.
So we are in a moment now when the fulfillment of a long-term conservative evangelical project is at hand. As we are speaking now, a leaked draft, a draft copy of a Supreme Court opinion, which would overturn Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion nationwide under certain circumstances, is now at hand. There is a hyper-conservative Supreme Court majority, which seems poised to do that, seems willing to do that, seems intentional about doing that. But what effect do you think it'll have more broadly?
Bump beds, shaved heads, Saturday night, a warehouse of strangers with 60 white lights, staring through the ceiling, just wanting to be, lay one of too many, a young PFC. Donald. There were spaces between Donald and whatever he said. Strangers had forced him to live in his head. He envisioned the details of romantic scenes after midnight in the stillness. The barracks, the train. A dreamer just comes natural, like the first breath from a baby, like sunshine feeding daisy, like love hidden deep in your heart. Thank you.
portrait of him is hung on the wall. Nothing is wrong and nothing is right. Donald and Lydia made love that night. Love. They made love beyond the mountains. They made love beyond the streams. They made love beyond the valleys. They made love in their dreams. But when they were finished, there was nothing to say. Cause mostly they made love from 10 miles away. But dreaming just comes natural, like the first breath from a baby, like sunshine feeding Daisy, like the love hidden deep in your heart.
It is an extraordinary story, for without the Schaefers, this culture war might not have been so fired up. And Frank is joining me now from Boston. His latest book is called Fall in Love, Have Children, Stay Put, Save the Planet, Be Happy.
Yes, it's like hearing about someone else's life conducted on a different planet. You know, I did the work with my father and the pro-life movement in the 1970s. I'm now pushing 70 years old. This is 50 years ago, and as I look back, I can only say that not only do I regret the impact we had, of course, it was completely unforeseen, all the way up to including the murder of abortion doctors, the fact that now it looks like Roe v. Wade will be rolled back by a Supreme Court dominated by Republican operatives that have taken what we did back in the 1970s and extrapolated that out into a future 50 years later. That I find shocking. I would describe myself as one of liberal political views. I'm a father and grandfather. And from this perspective in my life, I look back on what I did in my youth, maybe the way I guess some people would at wartime experiences or political experiences, maybe in the 1930s in Europe, if they had joined one of the fascist parties, lived to see it play out in a world war and what happened. I feel much that level of regret and culpability. And C. Everett Koop, who then was Surgeon-in-Chief of Philadelphia Children's Hospital, who a few years later would become Ronald Reagan's Surgeon General, a political appointee, was a friend of my family's, also an evangelical Christian. And he came to my father's ministry, which was in Switzerland, by the way, even though it was an American English-speaking ministry called Labrie Fellowship. And he talked me, as someone barely out of my teens, into a very staunch anti-abortion position. He said, look, you talk about Roe v. Wade in the last episode of How Should We Then Live? You need to make a whole series. Now, I have to be honest, and it saddens me, that at the time, it was also the idea of another paycheck. I was newly married. I was a teenage father talking about teen pregnancy and abortion. I was kind of living it. My wife, Jeannie, and I, we've been together 52 years now, and it worked out. But back at the time, we just had this little girl, Jessica, and I was saying, well, you know, we kept our child. Abortion is horrible. I listened to C. Everett Koop, and I was convinced. I was sincere. And so I talked my father into making the series. And, of course, one of my regrets is looking back, it was totally unfair. We were living in a community. We had support. My parents were helping me. We were living free of charge in the mission. The kind of idea that somehow we had this child and everything turned out okay, and so everybody ought to be able to do this was really... You'd had to be a kind of an idiot 20, 21-year-old, 22-year-old that I was at the time, selfish, self-involved, to not be able to understand that that was not the position most people who were facing difficult pregnancies were in. So that's how it started. I was convinced by C. Everett Koop, and then I convinced my dad, and then we went from there.
And you went from there to make this film with C. Everett Koop. And this film was called Whatever Happened to the Human Race. Again, it was an anti-abortion sort of doctrine.
The only reason I was directing the movie, I'd been making Super 8 films for people who remember movies, nepotism pure and simple, you know, me and the Korean leaders. I was a Schaefer, my father was a big evangelical star, and so I got the job. And it turned out that I had enough talent to make a strong piece of propaganda that was very effective. It was effective with evangelical audiences, but here's the thing that I think most people don't understand. At the time we brought this out in a seminar series from in about 1978 through to 1980, evangelicals were not interested. Not only that, They didn't want to know. Our friend Billy Graham, the great evangelist, was pro-choice. Most evangelicals don't know that. He refused to participate with us in our seminars, even though he and my father were friends. He said, Fran, you know, you've made a mistake here. I think people, women ought to have a choice. Dr. Criswell of the Southern Baptist Convention, the president of the Southern Baptist Convention, and for Americans, they will understand that's the most conservative group of evangelicals in America. He was pro-choice. He even preached sermons on choice. We had to convince evangelicals. You know, I think a lot of commentators looking back think somehow this was always part of the evangelical movement. It was not. Abortion was legal in the United States up until the 19th century when, and into the early 20th century when the American Medical Association tried to push women out of the midwife business, as it were, and take this over for professional gynecologists and so on. It had not been part of American history to be anti-abortion. It was a new phenomena that we had to talk evangelicals into. But once we talked them into it, the reason it became a thing is Republican leaders like our friend Jack Kemp, Gerald Ford, the president, my parents were friends with his. They would stay in the White House. His son, Mike, was living in my house. His wife, Gail, was babysitting our daughter, Jessica, et cetera, et cetera. We were very connected with the early stages of the religious right. Once other evangelical leaders saw this as an easy fundraising tactic to keep people angry, babies are being murdered, we can raise money. And when people like Jack Kemp and Ronald Reagan and other people we knew realized that the apathetic evangelical majority that didn't even care about voting suddenly could be energized because they had lost the fight on segregation. And these segregationists like Jerry Falwell, now we gave them something new to fight. And so two big agendas happened, an anti-gay agenda and an anti-abortion agenda. And the anti-abortion agenda became the litmus test, became the red meat. That's why it caught on. It caught on because of money, fundraising by evangelical leaders, and it caught on because the Republicans suddenly said, aha, this apathetic group that barely votes and half of them vote for Democrats, we can energize them if we can create this into a moral crusade. So it was a very convenient thing for Republican leaders. Not only was it not a political issue, you have to understand our big fight was with evangelicals. The editorial board of Christianity Today magazine, the bastion flagship of evangelical Christianity, they were pro-choice at the time. They refused to endorse our film. Billy Graham, Dr. Criswell, on and on and on. It changed when it became a matter of convenience. And then the next thing that happened is that leaders like Jerry Falwell, who had been a segregationist, decided his next big issue was going to be to fight the gay rights movement and the pro-life movement. He would adopt these things as a kind of a clarion call to his people. They were talked into this by my dad. And before that, they had not been in this camp. Well, Jimmy Carter was too decent a human being. He was compassionate to women. He was pro-choice. He was not a racist. He believed in integration. He wanted to increase voter rights for African Americans. Jerry Falwell was a segregationist. He was a far-right winger. He was a homophobe and a nasty piece of work. Jerry Falwell and these other guys could not manipulate Jimmy Carter. But they were far more interested in the politics they left behind, became totally politicized, and were no longer even a religion anymore, but a political movement of the far right.
And very, very effective legal movement, too, that has waged this campaign by the National Association of Evangelicals. They say, evangelical commitment to protecting the unborn stems from our deep understanding that God created human beings in his image and that every human life from conception to death has inestimable worth.
Well, first of all, the evangelicals do not believe that, because if they did, they would be fighting for paid parental leave so fathers and mothers could go home and be with their children instead of women going back to work three low-paid jobs with a terrible minimum wage while they're still bleeding from a cesarean section. Evangelicals don't care about that. They would not have fought, as the Republicans did, against the child tax credit that for a brief shining moment lifted millions of American children out of poverty. But they're not going to spend that money. They want to get rid of it. They call it socialism. If this group of people was pro-life and actually were consistent in their pro-life position, you could have some admiration for them while disagreeing on the matter of choice. But they are an anti-family group of people who put the welfare of billionaires in this country ahead of children, ahead of women, ahead of poor people, ahead of families. They're not even for paid parental leave. They're not for the child tax credit. They do nothing for children in terms of schools and education. They have never raised the minimum wage. They believe in people working 2-3 jobs on the margin of poverty, and tough luck, you're on your own. So the minute that child is born, they are anti-life. They're not just anti-choice. And so this is a hypocritical movement. And then I want to say a second thing. When it comes down to these moral issues of choosing life, it all is a matter of trust. Who do we trust? Do we trust judges on the Supreme Court or the federal bench put there by Donald Trump in a bargain with people like Ralph Reed and the other evangelical leaders like Franklin Graham, who said, look, here's our list from the Federalist Society. You appoint them and we'll bring you millions of voters. And it worked. Or do we trust women? But we have to trust someone. If you don't trust women, why would you trust a gynecologist, a male white gynecologist? If you don't trust women to make choices, why would you trust a group of 9 judges instead of the individual woman in making the choice? I trust women. Does that mean I think women or men or non-binary people, whomever, always make the right choice? No. But you've got to give someone the choice in these matters, all matters, where to educate a child, who to marry, pair bonded, to live a gay lifestyle, to be non-binary, whatever. These are choices that belong to individuals. They do not belong to the state. So when you see what's happening now, you understand that it's not going to end there. Look at Gorsuch. Look at these people who sat there in the Senate confirmation hearing and looked right into the eyes of the senators and said, we believe that this is a stated principle that will not be changed. They gave their word. They said they would not change it. These are people are political ideologues. And the same ideology that takes away the right to choose is going to take away the right to gay marriage. The same ideology that is now changing the law in state house after state house in favor of Republican, not only gerrymandering, but the kind of thing that Donald Trump said, where he's still claiming to be president somehow, that the vote was stolen, and now all of a sudden voting rights themselves are in question. If you had gone back 40 years ago and asked Gerald Ford or any of these people, are you ever going to be part of a Republican Party that's going to push against voter rights for African Americans, they would have said, that's never going to happen.
Right.
It's happening now. And so if anyone thinks that these people, I have to explain something to you. You know, you have an Iranian background. You're going to get these words. We are trying in this country to fight against people who are not just Democrats, but anybody who believes in democracy, people who believe in a theocracy. And what these people want is a Christian, white, nationalist version of what you have in Iran today and Saudi Arabia.
It's 1932. You're a young, poverty-stricken, working-class German with a starving family. You haven't had a job for months. Your savings have been wiped out. You're about to be evicted. You fought and saw the unimaginable during the First World War. 2 million of your countrymen, that's men you and your family often knew, died, sometimes horrifically. 1.5 million disabled veterans struggled to survive up and down the country. Addiction, alcoholism, prostitution, suicide, they're all endemic. Germany has been made to sign a humiliating peace treaty, pay unreasonable and economically devastating reparations to America, Britain and France, and cede territory on all of its borders. Then, to top it off, the Great Depression hits. Liberalism and democracy are failing. Hyperinflation reaches 1,000% per month. Even money is becoming worthless. Election after election fail to reach a majority, and Parliament, that's the Reichstag, is unable to govern. Conservatives, liberals, communists, authoritarians, the church, the army, they're all competing for power. Moral values and attitudes are blurred too. Religious belief continues to decline. Women's liberation sweeps Europe. Morals loosen. The jazz scene hits. To many, though, all of this depravity seems to be contributing to what's happening. Germany is at risk of extinction. Enter Adolf Hitler. Charming, charismatic, seemingly brilliant. After being elected in 1933, he quickly revitalizes the German economy. Problem after problem seem to be miraculously fixed. You get a job, roads are built, reparations are halted. A wave of euphoria sweeps across the nation. Life in Germany becomes good again. Why? Because Hitler and the National Socialists stand firmly against all the things that were causing its destruction. The greedy capitalists, godless communists, determined to overthrow the state, vindictive enemy countries abroad and an enemy within that connects all of these things, that's responsible for them all, that wants you dead, the Jews. For almost 10 years, you're surrounded by anti-Semitic propaganda and conspiracy theory. The Jews control Wall Street, Hollywood, America, Britain, the Soviet Union. Then the war starts. They threaten to take all of it away from you, all those things you've gained. You're too old to fight in the army, but you're drafted into the reserve police force. One morning, on duty in occupied Poland, you're roused from your bed and are driven to a nearby village. Your commander, Major Wilhelm Trapp, known to you affectionately as Papa Trapp, is pale-faced, has a choking, shaky voice and tears in his eyes. He informs you of your orders. Remember, he says, back home, bombs are falling on your wives and daughters too. The Jews in the village were involved with the partisans, the enemy. It's us or them. They must be rounded up and taken to the work camp. But those not able to work, women, children, the elderly, must, unfortunately, be shot. Trapp makes you an offer. You can be excused from this task if you wish. You look briefly at your friends, but don't take up the offer. Instead, you step forward, take the men, women, and children into the forest, order them onto the ground, aim, and pull the trigger. 2 million men, women, and children would be murdered this way, and at least 4 million more in the death camps and gas chambers. And statistically speaking, you would become a murderer in that way too. You would participate in the Holocaust.
All right, we're back. It's the Evolutionary. So, I should have put Milton Friedman on because it's just really, he gets me down. I guess is the best thing. You know, because I said,
all I can see is Pinochet. Every time I hear Milton Friedman, I just think of Chile and Pinochet, the dictator.
Well, and Phil Donahue's great. He's one of my favorite interviewers from that time. And he said, you've been the advisor to several presidents. Well, that was Nixon and Ford. Right?
I was wondering. Yeah, I was wondering about that. Yeah.
And so Friedman was involved with war crimes with both presidents.
Yeah, really, yeah. Operation Condor was the name of one of the murderous little schemes that they came up with. Excuse me, I just had to throw that in.
Google. Yeah, well, no, I think I slipped in a Phyllis Schlafly interview by Larry King somewhere in one of these. and the Equal Rights Amendment. She, 1983-84, she was victorious.
And I
tried to put together a joke, and I hope it works. As Jerry Falwell used to say about Phyllis Schlafly, she was as good looking as a hooker on Sunday with a who just got a donation.
Well, her hairstyle alone set her off. I mean, she had a. It was like a I don't know what you call those things. It's like a honey, a beehive on your head.
Mm-hmm. And those
like
things, last a month. They could last a month until the next time they go to hear.
It's like sculpture.
So it's pretty interesting, the task, And she was complaining, it's like, they refused to budge on the Equal Rights Amendment. Not one comma, is what she said. And it's like, I'm glad. That was worth listening to her for 20 minutes. They would not budge on human rights.
Yeah. All right.
The last guy
got to kick in. The last guy that played that was talking was Frank Schaefer, and he's archived. Some of his shows with me are archived, and I think they're up on the Fighting Cockflyer blog spot. It's a wild name, but I've used it since 1995. And Schaefer appeared, he wrote a book called Why I Am an Atheist That Still Believes in God. He's got a great sense of humor in a sense. But that was Frank Schaefer on CNN, man. I wondered if you caught that. That's great.
Yeah. And what was the title of his book? Don't have children and save the earth or something.
That's really since he's sort of retired, he paints a lot, and he has this little shack outside his place, and he paints a lot and helps in taking care of the grandkids, and he comes up. I'm sure he did the cover. Yeah, it's like have something, have kids to be happy, something. I don't know how to describe it. He's multi-talented. That's what he is, really. Real Renaissance guy.
Mm-hmm.
But where are we going now? That's a creepy. That was a creepy reading of something. But that guy with that accent and that music, who was that? Can you remember?
Well, yeah, it was. I got it off YouTube. I just found it. It was Then and Now. Is on YouTube. Yeah. It's the page. That grabbed me, and so I had to put that. I just had to put that in there, and so I've been trying to listen to some of his other stuff and see if I can maybe pull something in the future, so May Day came and there was a conference call about union busting at ACLU in Kansas City, and we've had Justice Gatson on several times, and on our Saturday Night podcast, so since she's been on, she had been fired for union busting, and so. So there was about an hour and a half, 2 hours, where they talked about exactly the process, where they hire a hatchet man. The ACLU hires a hatchet man. And they did a really good job. But anyway, I thought, okay, we're gonna talk about union busting at the ACLU for the whole period, the whole hour. And then the Roe versus Wade thing slipped out. Is there a cigarette man at the Department of Justice like in the Watergate story?
I think it's a female clerk of the court. I don't know, but I would suspect that. We got a caller. I haven't screened the caller, but let's just put him on, okay, Carl?
Yeah.
We only got a few minutes. Let's see.
Okay.
You had your hand up, so you're on air live. What's your name?
Hey, it's Joe Wobb.
Oh, right.
From Kansas City.
Joe Wobb.
How's it going?
Oh, buddy, Joe Wobb.
I just wanted to clear something up before anybody yells at you. Justice Gatson was not fired for union busting. She was fired for trying to unionize the ACLU.
Oh, I'm okay. I'm sorry. Justice is not. She is not a union buster. She didn't work for Pinkertons. That's right.
No, she does not. Yeah.
Thanks. My mistake. Thank you, Joe Wall is my fact checker. And So how's your garden doing so far, Joe?
It's doing pretty good. I made up some pesticide with basically like soaked some garlic and a pack of cigarettes and some water and sprayed that on the underside of some kale that was getting eaten by bugs, and got some morel mushrooms out of the backyard and had those for dinner a couple days ago. That was pretty good. So, yeah, it's going all right.
Yeah. Well, that's great. So, what do you think about this Roe versus Wade thing? Because you grew up in Topeka, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, this is the kind of shit, that's why I left town.
Yeah. Yeah, Topeka's getting bigger and the world's getting smaller.
Yeah.
All right, we're gonna go on the next clip and you can call us back if I slip up again. Feel free, anytime.
Okay.
Joe. Thank you,
All
we
right.
appreciate you.
Will do.
Talk to you soon.
All right, bye.
Bye. Okay, so the next one's going to be 403. Hit it, Mike.
we do need your donation. Because I would have liked to provide transportation for some folks who are here today. Some marginalized folks that have been. And I couldn't go get them. Things like that people don't think about. That we need money for. So to get out here, to do this work, to get it going. And we need money to travel, to fight this shit. It is not easy work. It's grueling. It's exhausting. So if you can, give. But you know, I respect all forms of currency. I sure do. And time is money. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you got a little bit of time.
You got a little bit of time.
Waiting for you.
Okay. We're going to have a link out on our page for you to continue these actions. We are going to also be sharing whatever comes down with Leslie, whatever they need for us to know.
See, this is when we don't know when
you might have to just come to a call to action. I don't know how soon that might be, but this came together in less than 5 freaking hours. And I feel like I missed somebody who wanted to say something.
Yeah.
Did I? Somebody had something burning.
Okay.
So do we?
Maybe go first.
Okay. Hi, my name's Ahavia. I use they, them pronouns. And I have been having nightmares about pregnancy and giving birth since I was very, very young. When my partner told me about this last night, I kind of just felt stuck. And seeing everybody out here today means that it's not just me who's stuck.
Yep.
It's all of us, right?
Yep.
And I want to remind you that everybody here who has a uterus and everybody here who doesn't have a uterus and everyone who has something in between, they're going to be affected by this. Not having access to a work, it means that you are going to be put in a state of poverty if you're already in it. Raising a child, you're never financially stable enough to have a child. And some people make the choice, and they're so incredibly strong and brave for that. But that's not for me. It's not for this uterus, and specifically. So when you're talking about this, make sure that you are talking to them. Because they're having a shit-ass time of it right now. I don't want to see another kid younger than me who's also having these same nightmares about pregnancy have to go through this. I don't know what I do. This is something that pushes people to the brink of not wanting to be alive anymore. I know that I would struggle with that as well. So this is not only something that is putting you in a place of, like, check on people, make sure that you're supporting them, and make sure that when you're talking about this, you're talking not only about this, but you're talking about trans health rights, you're talking about women's health rights, you're talking about men's health rights, too. Don't forget that trans men have to do this shit. OBGYNs do not know how to treat trans men. Thank you for your time. Thank you for showing up. They don't have to worry about traveling several different states just to get okay? All right, repeat after me. Working women lead the fight.
Working women lead the fight.
Safe abortions is a right.
Safe abortions is a right.
Working women lead the fight.
Working women lead the fight.
But it's all coming up under us. They will not be okay. Somebody It's not going to be okay. You don't fight for this.
It's not. And many are in a position where they cannot fight. They are depending on you. When I told you I needed you, I wasn't lying. When I buried my soul and asked for a blessed prayer, I wasn't lying. We're on it. We're in it right now. Right now. Right now. So, are you with me?
Good evening, and welcome to another edition of Larry King Let's Talk, every Saturday night at 7 here on Channel 7. Tonight, an extraordinary lady. I think even her foremost critics would admit that. It's rare in American politics or American circles that one person, one individual, can change a whole concept. Phyllis Schlafly did that. We'll meet her on Larry King Let's Talk coming up. My special guest tonight is Phyllis Schlafly. I guess if we had a point to one thing, Phyllis Schlafly changed America by changing the vote on ERA. It was as simple as that. Do you feel like a Donna Quixote?
Well, every movement has to have a leader. We had millions of people on our side, and all I did was bring it all together.
But it all focused on you. By that I mean no political leadership was behind you. Gerald Ford was in favor of the ERA. Richard Nixon was in favor of the ERA. George Bush was in favor of
Jimmy
the ERA.
Jimmy Carter, don't forget him.
The president at the time. I mean,
well, it is
you
true.
Had a lot of windmills.
Well, the first the reason that motivated me was my realization that it would require young women to be drafted and put in military combat.
That was the first thing.
Yes, that was first. And more recently, you have an argument about losing the tax exemption of private and religious schools. And I realized that what these people really wanted was to take my 5'2" little girl and treat her just like a man and draft her and put her in basic training and teach her to kill and send her out into our country's wars just like the men. Yes, I do get emotional about that.
On that issue.
And see, they never denied it.
Yeah, but once you're in service, there is no democracy. The head of
That's
a base.
Right.
No, but the head of a base can choose to send women to conflict or not send them into conflict.
That's why we don't want our daughters drafted.
But most nations do draft
women, don't they?
Israel drafts women.
Oh, no, but they don't. Israel doesn't have an ERA. Israel treats women very differently.
Yeah, but I mean, there is no democracy in service. By that, I mean, I have freedom of movement in the United States, but if in the Army, they can send me to Colorado tomorrow.
That's
so
right.
Therefore, they can hold women out of conflict tomorrow. They don't have to put women into conflict because it's not a democracy.
That's correct.
So
but
why
we
would
also,
ERA be covered in service?
Because we have federal laws today that exempt women from combat duty. And those laws are obviously sex discriminatory. So they would become unconstitutional under ERA. And no commander could send a platoon of all males because that's obvious that he had discriminated any more than he could send a platoon to charge on the hill that were all whites or all blacks.
What if a woman wanted to fight and was capable of fighting?
They're not going to get my daughter. See, that's what it boiled down to, and that's the reason.
The polls show America favors it, though.
Look, I've run polls, and I've studied polls, and you can get any answer you want, depending on the way you construct the question. If you construct the question, do you want a constitutional rule that will require 18-year-old girls to be registered and drafted just like men and sent into combat, you know what the answer would be.
You said that they've refused to change it. How would you write it?
Well,
what would
I think
be the Phyllis Schlafly Amendment to the Constitution, or you don't think we need any?
Well, I don't think we need it. I proposed 9 separate amendments when I testified before the House Judiciary Committee. But the position of the advocates is they will not have a single one, not a single amendment. They won't change it by a comma. And so as a result of that, I will tell you that ERA is dead. Now, if you want equal education and employment opportunity, I think women have it. I think they can go into any career that they want. They can have any type of education. I think that the laws are all in place, and women have a great cafeteria array of careers they can select.
How do you react when they said it wasn't that way for you?
It was that way.
You were an activist.
I had every opportunity. I spent 20 years raising 6 children. I have not been in the paid labor force. I now am a lawyer, but there's no way that I could ever earn what my husband earns, who spent all his life in the law. I've only spent a few years in it. I spent 20 years raising sick children.
Our guest is Phyllis Schlafly, who heads an organization called the Eagle Forum. I know after they discovered the cure for polio, the Jonas Salk and the folks at the March of Dimes decided to get into numerous birth problems because they had a psychological problem after defeating it, to stir their workers up. What are you out after now? Where I knew Phyllis Schlafly from reading you and hearing you on CBS Radio was foreign affairs and weaponry. That's your expertise, weaponry, right?
Right. Well, I served on the National Security Subcommittee on the Republican Platform Committee, and we have a great plank. We are wholly supporting Ronald Reagan's strategic space-based defense initiatives. And
but I meant, aren't you annoyed that most Americans see you as ERA when your expertise...
That's the
I mean, you know from
the
missile heads and warheads and
right.
MIRVs, you know all that.
Right.
Doesn't bother you that the public doesn't perceive you that way?
That's the decision of the media who run things. On how they have pictured me to the audience, and that's something over which I have no control. I have sold millions of copies of my books, but the media have chosen to paint me a particular way, just as they are now trying to paint Ronald Reagan as though he's a loser in the debates. And they're trying to tell us that all the women are going to vote for Ferraro. Now, I don't think those things are true, but there they are. They are media decisions.
Thank you, Phyllis.
Thank you.
Phyllis Schlafly, stay tuned for Ebert and Siskel. This is Larry King. We're here with Let's Talk every Saturday night at 7.
All right. We're back. Abolitionist Hour. Rocking in the free world. So that was Justice Gadsden. Okay, so back into my story where I got mixed up. So there was a situation where several people were fired at ACLU for organizing and just for organizing the workplace and trying to get better pay for the line. And
I visited with Justin. I'm sorry, could I just say, offer a short observation?
Okay.
Paul, can I?
Yeah.
Can I?
Yeah.
All right. It'll just be a minute or no more.
That's fine.
You know, ACLU is a non-profit, and I hate to say this, but I mean, you heard earlier when Richard Wolf was talking about non-profit hospitals in the first hour. So, I mean, it was sort of interesting. I've been thinking about it. I just wanted to let people know that we've gotten there are many flaws with the ACLU as a nonprofit. It's just, their mailing operations outrageous, and it's just incredible. And because we get all their mail and stuff, and it's I'm telling you, there's. I just want to remind people, there's probably with some big bucks behind ACLU, and that's all I wanted to say, Carl. You want to introduce this next clip?
We'll finish up. We'll have some time, and then we'll chat for about the last 10 minutes. Okay, this is Julie Goldberg. I follow her on Twitter. Works as a librarian and ran for New York Senate in 2018. And so this was her speech, and then she's got the NBC, MSNBC, all the microphones on the podium, and this is Julie Goldberg. And 404, hit it.
In this treacherous moment. But I have to say that looking around at this crowd, this diverse crowd of committed leaders and activists, people from every community in this city and state, that gives me hope. We need to come together today and every day to shout a no that will be heard from Union Square all the way to the steps of the Supreme Court. Let me hear it now. Are we going to let them take away our right to choose? Authority over black and brown people. people, where able people had authority over disabled people, and where the rich had authority over all the rest of us. And these are dangerous times. These people are dangerous because no oppressor in history ever went down without a fight. We see their desperate clinging to this old order in the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. They want the dead hands of their old oppressive order pressing down on our children and grandchildren decades after they're gone. They are dangerous the way a cornered animal is dangerous. Reckless because they know their time is almost done. But we here, we are not waiting patiently for the end of this old order. We can't, not like our lives and our daughters' lives are on the line. Because you cannot outlaw abortion. You can only outlaw safe and legal abortion. And we are not going to let anyone drag us back to the days of back alley abortions where women died. Abortion rights are equality rights. Abortion rights are the rights to bodily autonomy. And there is no two ways about that. There is no middle ground, compromise, IDC, kind of nebulous middle ground on that issue. It does not exist. Either you believe that the state has authority over our bodies, or you believe that we have the first and last word about our bodies and every word in between. If the state can tell us when, where, and how we can exercise our right to bodily autonomy, then these are not rights, but privileges. And I refuse to believe or to accept the idea that your bodily autonomy or mine is a privilege to be doled out by President Donald Trump, or John Roberts, or New York Senate Majority Leader John Flanagan, or Senator Jeff Klein, or Senator David Carlucci, or anyone else. The battle for women's equality is a long one, and it has inexcusably excluded so many people. Disabled women, women of color, poor women, Native women, immigrant women, queer women, and people of all genders or none, but not anymore. We are all in this together now, fighting this fight against this dying old order of oppressive authority, and we will win. Our generation did not begin the fight for full equality and bodily autonomy, but I'm telling you, we will end it. Thank you. Just had to lie.
All right, we're back.
Now, wait a minute. Was Paul McCartney even there? I don't know if listeners picked up on this, but that was Neil Young.
Yeah.
Was Paul McCartney even there?
No. He had three backup singers. He had three backup singers singing. So that's how they made that work.
It worked out real well. All right.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. I just had to.
Well, no, that's one of my favorite Beatle covers. So I'll look for other people that cover that. I know Jeff Beck has a great version.
Wow.
I've read that part of the song where it says he blew his mind out in a car was about Jeff Beck's car wreck.
And
management stole Rod Stewart away from Faces.
Oh, I remember Faces. I remember.
Yeah,
that.
I mean,
band.
Just imagine if Rod Stewart but I mean, Jeff Beck gets the best singers anyway. But Jeff Beck has always well. What he did was he went down to Memphis to the Stax Studio and did a cover album of Stevie Wonder songs.
Oh, I bet those are good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting.
And
speaking
so,
of which,
yeah.
Speaking of which.
Okay, so let's go to 405 and see if we can get Justice in, because I might have another 5-minute Neil Young song on that one, too.
Okay,
but we'll see.
Right, all right.
405.
Workers' rights, they are definitely human rights. And we're coming today to talk about some experiences that we've had while trying to unionize the workplace. We think it's important to share what we've experienced and what we've learned to other people, especially on May Day, the day that we celebrate workers and the day that we celebrate our rights. Because we do have a right to organize. We do have a right to demand better work conditions. And we know that across the country, businesses, organizations have faced tremendous union busting. And so I have a story to share, but I also have other folks who have stories to share as well. And so what I'd like to do, I think, first to get us started, because not only am I talking to other folks at this time, I'm also sharing my story too, which has been pretty traumatic. And so I joined the ACLU in August of 2017. So I have been organizing since I was a child in my city. From the first time I heard about how we couldn't go to the plaza, I wanted to speak out. And then I found out other things. And so it's just been a lifelong thing for me, speaking out and organizing from an early age. Wasn't working for the ACLU, but I was definitely very active in my community. And it's really the reason that the ACLU sought me out as an organizer who is, you know, grassroots, in the streets, completely, you know, with the community. That was, you know, a concern about, you know, who is this big organization? What do they want from me? You know, those kinds of things. But I think a big, you know, an even bigger thing for me, because I can handle myself, is that I'm a disabled person. I'm differently able. I have a chronic illness.
And I had major concerns about if that organization could work with me the way that I can work. For months, I put off this organization, even though they kept telling me, we're hiring. When I realized that they were trying to hire me, we had that very candid conversation about my disability, about, you know, how I was feeling. And I will tell you that the executive director and my direct supervisor both reassured me that that would, you know, my illness would not be a problem, that they could and would accommodate me in my position. And they did. Early out, you know, I had a different kind of arrangement. My partner was driving me to certain places. I was doing things in a different way, yet I was very effective and I was getting my job done. And so I never had any problem until, you know, we can talk about when I started having problems with that. But yeah, very welcoming coming into the organization. I felt really, really good about it. And so I did join. I guess there were red flags all along the way in a sense, because my first day was a Monday. It was the following weekend that had been Charlottesville. And if y'all know, you know, what happened in Charlottesville that year, 2017, when those racist folks with the tiki torches and all of that, and then coming into the organization and finding out that the ACLU chapter in Charlottesville actually helped the other side. It was a very contentious first day. I will say that my brand new colleagues who I had met on a conference call were very angry and voiced their anger the entire day over that situation. And so it was weird coming in right off the heels of that. You know, what I saw was just disconnect between the organizers and those who were more in charge, those leading in a sense. And, you know, we have to remember where the ACLU is at this time. Let me take you back. Trump has won, and people are pissed. And so they're flooding progressive organizations with money. They're saying, do something. The ACLU decide that it is a good time to maybe hire organizers. Yes, organizers. But they didn't expect what organizers bring. And if you're unfamiliar with organizers and organizing, then that may come as a shock that there are people who actually work and live by a certain set of standards. And they work with integrity that won't be crossed by anyone and not a company, especially an organization that is proclaiming to be progressive. And so that's what happened, you know. They're hiring organizers. They're hiring previously incarcerated folks, people with lived experience, people who know their stuff on a deeper level than just say, I took a class and, you know, I know constitutional rights and now I can go work for this organization. We're talking about people who have been in the system. We're talking about people who see and they love ones in the system and the things that they had to go through. So these are the people now that you're bringing into the organization. And here I am, one of them. I have people who have been impacted by the system. So this work isn't just, oh, you know, we're fulfilling our grant needs or we're, you know, doing what our donors want. At this point, the work is, no, this is our life. And so it gives a different air to the work. It makes it more meaningful. It makes it meaningful. And so us organizers, previously incarcerated folks, we added a great depth of value to the work that the ACLU was trying to do and trying to accomplish, bringing our sincere expertise and our sincere lens to that work. Now, what we met is what people often meet, and that is white supremacist culture. I mean, but the ACLU, the Missouri affiliate at least, just celebrated 100 years old. And so we know that America, upon its founding, was built on terror, you know, was built on racism. And so for 100 years, that organization, it doesn't matter how progressive it is, could escape that very real history.
And so, you know, organizers, activists, previously incarcerated folks, we're bringing that to the floor and we're saying, hey, these are the ways in which this organization has operated that have been harmful and are harmful. And this is what we want to do now. You've had 100 years, right? And now what are we going to do for the next 100 years? When I came into the organization, I saw that. I began working with other organizers from other affiliates, and we put out a letter to all affiliate executive directors across all affiliates, including the national ED. We ended up getting a meeting with Anthony Romero because of this. I won't dig too far into that, but I'll say it was our organizing efforts that really pushed the thought of unionization across the various affiliates. Because although the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, has union in the name, it was not a unionized body. And I'll tell you, people were surprised to know that the ACLU is we're not unionized. It wasn't something that the organization pushed. They say that they support it.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knife and armor come and save something bound queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming in the arches with the trees. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 2017. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 2017. I was lying in a burned out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a placement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was life. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was life. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship lying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children flying and colors flying all around the chosen ones. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. They were flying Mother Nature's silver seat to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seat to a new home.
Jeez, I love that.
The bum on the rods is hunted down as an enemy of mankind. The other is driven around to his club, is feted, wined, and dined. And they who curse the bum on the rods as the essence of all that's bad will greet the other with a winning smile and extend the hand so glad. The bum on the rods is a social flea who gets an occasional bite. The bum on the plush is a social leech, blood-sucking day and night. The bum on the rods is a load so light that his weight we scarcely feel. but it takes the labor of dozens of folks to furnish the other a meal. As long as we sanction the bum on the plush, the other will always be there. But rid ourselves of the bum on the plush and the other will disappear. Then make an intelligent, organized kick. Get rid of the weights that crush. Don't worry about the bum on the rods. Get rid of the bum on the plush.